This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, just so you know, this episode features conversations about drugs and addiction. If you need more information, please refer to the NHS website or search Talk to Frank to find out more. Welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science, in a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. Isaac Asimov once said the most exciting phrase in science is not Eureka, but that's funny. Our point is, you can have a bit of both. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Okay, question for you. What is the worst hangover you've ever had?
Oh no.
Don't censor this.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I want people to know. There was one hangover that I remember when my kids were really small. Mm-hmm. They were both going to primary school. And I was so hungover, I couldn't take them to school without going up to the bathroom and throwing up first. And so I had them at the front door, realised I wasn't going to make it to school. I was like, hang on, kids. I'll be back in a minute.
Yeah. What's wrong with daddy? Daddy's got some sort
daddy's
of poisoning.
Daddy's not very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that sticks in the mind. I mean, I've had the ones where, yeah, you just lie in bed and you don't move and you don't mm-hmm. open your eyes. Mm-hmm. But that one I felt was particularly poor because obviously I was in a position of responsibility.
Yeah, it's not great. It's not great. My worst hangover, now something, I'll give you a peek behind the curtain here, actually. So something quite funny happened. We are re-recording this answer because I previously told Brooksy about my worst hangover, and it's quite a it is quite a lively story, and I just thought I'll run it past my agent just in case, and so I sent it to my agent, and her response, and I think I can quote her here, was what the fuck, and she said that cannot go out on anything. Unless you want to end your career.
Which is, to be fair, I mean, it did make mine look very, very tame,
didn't
it?
It's a really, really, I mean, it's such a shame. It's such a shame. Maybe when I retire, I'll release the story around, like, we're not going to work anymore, so it doesn't matter.
I mean, I wish there was a way we could do it, just, like, you know, special subscriptions or something.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think that'll do it. It's a good, well, without wanting to big up my own story too much, it's a really good story.
Maybe it's something for OnlyFans.
It's a story that never gets a bad reaction. Like, it really, like, people are like, huh?
It escalates so much, doesn't it?
Like, it starts bad, and it goes yeah, somewhere you don't expect. But anyway, yeah. I'm not allowed to tell you about that because I would get in a great deal of trouble. So I'm actually going to go with what I think is my probably my second worst hangover. Very similar to you, and I can't remember what I was doing the night before, but I do remember the aftermath.
Yeah.
And it also involves children. And I had to go to a garden party somewhere out in the sticks of my friend, the same friend actually, who's involved really? In the other story. I think it was either his like 30th birthday or maybe like his mum and dad's wedding anniversary, something like that. So it's quite it's an afternoon sort of garden party. Yeah. It's quite
so
civilized,
dangerous.
Really.
Yeah.
There were quite a few of my friends there, but there's also a lot of like grown-ups.
Yeah.
And it's quite sort of, you know, it's civilized. I arrive and I've got a taxi from the station, and I feel so bad in the taxi. I've had to lie, it's like an old, like a classic sort of London cab, and I've just, so there's enough room, and I'm laying down on the filthy rubber floor because I can't even heave myself into a seat. And I arrive at this party, and I don't think I'm gonna be able to get through this. This is a horrible business. I see some of my friends. I go over and I sit with them. I look terrible. And Dan's mum, very kindly, sort of, I think she realises that I'm in a bit of trouble. And she says, I'll go and get you a nice big bottle of water. And I was like, oh, amazing. Thank you so much. I sit down with my friends. One of our friends has got a baby who at the time is probably, I guess, about 6 months old. And she says, go on, take your mind off it or whatever. Take the baby. So she sits the baby on my lap. Oh, now, no. I don't want a baby on my lap at this point, but there's nothing you can do when someone says, take the baby. So I take the baby and I'm like, great, fine. And then a couple of minutes later, Dan's mum arrives with this bottle of water. And I am so excited about the water that I just grab for it. I'm just like, oh, maybe. And then almost one of those things where it sort of feels like it's happening in slow motion. I am grabbing the water and I see the baby just tumbling off my lap, but there's nothing I can do about it. And the baby falls directly on its head.
Oh, fuck.
Directly on its head. And that's a really, I mean, to say it went down badly, it is an understatement, but I cannot emphasize enough, I needed that fucking water.
And the
baby's fine.
Really?
Yeah. Kid's fine. They're very, I think they're very resilient at that age, aren't they? They can take a bit of rough and tumble.
Dropping on the head's never a good idea, by the way.
A face plant, but more like top of head.
Top of the head.
Top of head whacking
soft
into.
Bit.
Yeah. So that's...
are you still friends with the parents?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah. I think they've... I mean, it does occasionally get referenced.
Tell me you're the godfather.
No, not the godfather. So that's my second worst hangover.
It's a
story.
Good one.
It's not as good. I know. Yeah,
it'll still do.
Complain to my agent.
Some newspapers have called acid house music a sinister and evil cult which lures young people into drug taking. The message is certainly getting across.
What do you know about acid house music?
There's meant to be a drugs related craze. Seems to be the most worrying thing.
And where did you find that out?
That was in the paper.
It must affect the brain in some way.
Unless it's just the music that does it.
Them lights flashing don't do you any good either, do it? I wouldn't even go in the pub where them lights are.
Oh,
they drive you mad, don't they?
Picture the scene. It's the second summer of love. Acid house has swept the UK. You want to be able to go all night, leave the rave when the sun comes up, and have the best night of your life. So you take a pill. It's ecstasy.
The definition of ecstasy is beside yourself, and it is like being beside yourself. It's like a new part of you that's just coming out in a pure way. It's just pure emotion coming out. And if emotion is madness, then yes, it is madness.
After half an hour, you notice your heart's beating faster, you're tingly all over, you're hot, a bit confused. Has the music changed? And then it washes over you. Pure euphoria.
I'm keep dancing forever, me. Well, at least I remember where I put my car.
The wickedest time ever I've ever experienced it, right?
You feel great as the lasers ripple over your body and the music thuds through your chest. So does everyone around you. But you know this high can't last forever.
It must affect the brain in some way.
Unless it's just the music that does it.
It must affect the brain in some way.
Whether we like it or not, drugs have been a part of our society for a long time. Archaeologists have discovered evidence that opium was being used in Europe by 5700 BC. Cannabis seeds have showed up in archaeological digs from 8000 BC in Asia. Whether we're smoking it, drinking it, eating it or snorting it, humans' innate desire to alter our minds has been going on for a long time. In fact, many people believe humans have been intoxicating themselves since civilization began. But that doesn't always come without consequence. In recent years, it's become an increasingly political debate.
We're seeing a lot of problems caused by these 300,000 problem drugs users. So what we're doing is we're ramping up our campaign against the county lines networks.
People are asking a lot of questions. Are drugs safe to legalise? Is it possible to live a healthy life whilst using drugs? And why do people want to take them so much? So today we're asking,
will we ever have safe, legal and ethical recreational drugs?
So Eureka's a show based in scientific fact.
Yes.
Presumably our expert this week is not a member of the Happy Mondays.
Yeah, I've booked Bez. This guy has been doing so much research for so long.
I mean, he knows his shit, doesn't he?
Did you see... yeah, you wouldn't have done. But did you see Dancing on Ice with Bez?
Yes, I saw a clip of it.
With the huge maracas. Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic. Because in a way, you're like... That's quite a funny booking, but will it actually be funny? And then he comes out with it. You're like,
it will be.
That's excellent. No, we haven't booked Bez. We've got a highly esteemed guest this week whose knowledge of drugs very much comes from scientific research.
Okay.
I'm assured he doesn't mind a tipple. Doesn't mind a little drink here and there. For this episode, we've spoken to David Nutt, a neuropsychopharmacologist. Who specialises in the research of drugs that affect the brain and conditions such as addiction, anxiety and sleep. He's been a member of the Committee on Safety of Medicines. He was president of the European College of Neuropsychopharmacology. He's currently the chairman of Drug Science, which is a non-profit that he founded in 2010 to provide independent evidence-based information on drugs. He was the government's drug czar.
He's absolutely the Don.
If you're going to talk about drugs... And legal drugs, ethical drugs, he's the man.
Okay.
For sure.
So what was the first question that we asked David?
I actually want him to go back to basics. And this is not as dumb a question as it sounds, I don't think. I just said, what is a drug?
Well, that is a great question. And one of the things that really... horrified me when I started working as the government's chief drugs advisor is that there was no definition of what a drug is, not under the Misuse of Drugs Act in Britain or indeed under the UN conventions. So I came up with my own definition, which a drug is something that a politician once used but now regrets. But then, of course, scientifically, a drug is a chemical, usually a molecule, a chemical, that produces physiological changes in the body. That's what a drug is. But recreational drugs is a big term. That ranges from legal drugs, such as alcohol and tobacco, through drugs such as nitrous oxide, which is sort of semi-legal, to drugs which are very illegal, drugs like crack cocaine and heroin. And different drugs work very differently in the brain. So there isn't a common mechanism. All you can say is that, by and large, when people take drugs recreationally, they're doing it either to get high, although in many cases, they're actually using drugs to reduce distress or stress or to deal with other problems in their life.
Okay, so, I mean, first of all, politicians have done a lot of things that they regret, presumably. Yeah. I mean, prostitutes are not drugs. Let's be clear on that.
No, they're not. They're not. Yeah, I mean, this is as soon as David Nutt starts speaking, you're like, obviously, I love this guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
this guy's a bit of a one.
And why? I mean, he talked about lots of reasons why people take drugs. Why do you take drugs, Rick?
Well, I don't anymore. I have to say, drugs don't really.
Do you have to say that because of your BBC contract?
Probably yes, but also they just don't agree with me. They never have. I do take. Occasionally, a bit of CBD.
A bit
of CBD oil. And I don't know if it's just psychosomatic, but I feel like it's sort of slightly...
What do you take it for? Just kind of a little de-stressing?
A bit stressed.
Yeah.
You know, just want to relax. Maybe if I'm thinking, I just need to sleep, I might put a couple of drops under the old tongue.
Yeah.
Don't use it very often. And genuinely have no idea if it has any effects, but I quite...
Well, it's like your face creams, isn't it?
Yeah. I've got a lot of potions that I spend my money on, and I've got no idea if it's...
Maybe you should rub CBD oil over your face.
I've actually got a CBD muscle rub
that
I haven't used, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So, I'll let you know. Or I'll rub some into you if you like.
After the show.
But I can't... like weed, for example, has never agreed with me. It gives me a headache.
Yeah.
Harder drugs, I think I've tried a few, but I'm just a bit scared of them, if
yeah,
I'm honest.
No, that's like fair
I've
enough.
Just yeah. So it's not been not really been a part of my life drugs, particularly. Yeah. Alcohol has been, although not anymore. Like, it was a big, I mean, I used to drink a lot too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when you start drinking as a teenager, it's not to reduce stress. It's because everyone else is doing it and it's kind of fun and you have fun while you do it. So,
yeah.
You know, there comes a point in your life where you're sort of thinking, okay, alcohol's not really a thing anymore. You know, it's fine in small doses, but I'm not, you know, or for me anyway, it's I'm just sort of not that bothered that much anymore. And me and my friends will go out and we'll have a couple of pints and then it'll just start to tail off. Like, we're not that interested in the third or the fourth one most of the time. So alcohol's
you know, without wanting to sound too much like I'm getting incredibly old, but if I have four pints, I am absolutely lashed now. Really? Genuinely. I'm all over the place and I'll have such a bad hangover. What I realise is I really like the taste of lager.
Yeah.
And some of the no-alcohol lagers now are genuinely really good. And so I'll be just as happy drinking. So you go out for a curry and you want to have a lager. I'll just have a couple of no-alcohol ones and I'll enjoy it. Yeah, just as much, I'd say.
Yeah.
Which suggests that the alcohol's not doing anything for me. 42.
Good God.
Yeah, I know. But you've got to be honest about these things. That's just sort of where I found myself.
So what aren't you doing for your brain and body that you could be doing?
Yeah, really. Honestly, this thing is a temple. We should talk a bit about how drugs do affect the brain.
Yeah.
And as David was saying, there's not a single mechanism. But sort of overall, what they're doing is they're changing your brain chemistry. So they're altering your mood, your emotions, your behavior, to some extent your perceptions, and therefore that changes how you kind of interact with the world. And they interfere at a kind of molecular level with your neurons. So the neurons in your brain, and they do that in three different ways. So the neurons, they can affect how they send messages, how they receive messages from one another, and then how they process those messages. And it's all via neurotransmitters. So your neurons communicate with each other through synapses. So they've got these kind of spindly little like spines, I think they're called. And then in between, you've got the synapse, and then you've got neurotransmitters that actually transmit the message. And so different drugs impact those processes in different ways. So you can look at like marijuana and heroin. They just mimic the structure of natural. We've got loads of neurotransmitters in our brain, obviously. They just mimic that structure. So they'll attach to synapses or whatever and activate neurons. And the reason that they have a sort of effect is that the activation is not the same as with a natural neurotransmitter. So you get slightly sort of abnormal messages.
Yeah.
So that's kind of one method of interference that drugs do. And then you've got like amphetamines and coke, and they just cause neurons to release a shitload of neurotransmitters.
Right.
And so that kind of amplifies and disrupts the sort of normal communication. And then opioids, and we have naturally occurring opioids, so endorphin is an opioid, that they kind of affect your brainstem more and kind of disrupt things like, you know, like autonomous functions, like sort of heart rate and breathing and sleep. And so that's just a selection of different ways that drugs affect your brain chemistry.
Because we are, I mean, we're just chemistry, aren't we, basically?
Yeah, entirely.
So you can hack that chemistry with these substances.
Yeah, and that's what's happening. And then I guess the interesting bit is the areas that are being affected have different roles in terms of your emotional state and so on. So there's three bits of the brain that are kind of principally involved and affected by drugs that have the impacts that you see. So you've got the basal ganglia, and that's one of the key nodes of the reward circuit. So everything to do with how you feel pleasure, so through natural things like eating or sex or whatever, and it gets overactivated by drugs, the reward circuit, and that can lead to this kind of euphoria. But then the problem is that repeated exposure makes the circuit adapt. The brain's very adaptable, so it becomes less sensitive. And it starts to mean that you only experience pleasure from the drug.
Yeah.
And presumably
you need more and more of the drug to get to the same level.
Absolutely.
It's a bitch, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. And it's the brain's adaptation to drugs that is really the key problem.
Yeah.
And then you've got the prefrontal cortex, which is where sort of anxiety and unease and sort of depression tends to be centered around. And that's actually associated with more with kind of drug with withdrawal. So in time, a person with addiction actually starts to use drugs, not really for the high, but just to relieve the discomfort, the withdrawal. So the high becomes a distant memory.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not getting that high.
You're just trying to return to normal.
Yeah, you're trying to get back to normal and not feel awful.
Yeah,
it's sort of what's happening.
I mean, that's what cigarettes do, isn't it? That's what nicotine does. Effectively, is put you into a state where you just want to return to normal.
And extremely addictive.
Yeah,
extremely addictive. And then the one last bit is the it's called the extended amygdala, and this is it's the last part of the brain to mature, actually, which means that adolescents are particularly sort of vulnerable to this. And it's kind of involved in thinking and planning and problem solving and crucially self-control. So drug use can actually sort of make your impulse control less good. And that in itself starts to make you seek drugs more compulsively. You're less able to control that impulse. And so then you get into a bit of a vicious cycle, basically. And in terms of where the actual high comes from, for a long time, people thought it was all to do with dopamine. But dopamine, it seems, is more about making you want something rather than actually liking the thing. So it sort of reinforces, it makes you desire the thing. And this is all called reinforcement. So it gets you to repeat pleasurable activities. It's not directly responsible for euphoria, that dopamine, but it is an issue, and it kind of, you get a burst of dopamine almost as a reminder to say you should do this again, and that obviously then forms habits. So you get this euphoria and surges of dopamine from drugs, and then that sort of reinforces the connection between the drug and the resulting pleasure, and you're teaching the brain to seek the drug, effectively at the expense of other activities that you would have been doing normally that could have given you similar highs.
So the brain turns it into a compulsive behavior.
Yes, exactly. And crucially, like the sort of the drug rewards are greater than natural rewards. And so then your brain starts to turn down its sensitivity. So the person's less able to experience pleasure from quote unquote natural activities,
right?
And then you're sort of unable to enjoy things that you previously would have found pleasurable, and you end up just feeling sort of flat and lifeless, possibly depressed without the drug, because again your brain has adapted, and because your tolerance builds up, you need more drugs, as we're saying, to produce the same high.
Nice.
Really nice. Really, really nice. But it doesn't make me think, I should be doing more drugs.
No, me neither. It basically makes me think, oh no, we don't have free will, do we? It's just, chemicals interact with us, and if we let the wrong chemicals interact with us, we're kind of screwed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Luckily, I mean, the biggest high I get these days is basically walking the countryside. So that's kind of...
Or a good sleep.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
We'll take a quick break now, but we'll be back after this to discuss how addictive tobacco and alcohol are compared to hard drugs, the war on drugs and its effect on research, and of course we'll be hearing Professor David Nutt's answer to this week's question, will we ever have safe, legal and ethical recreational drugs?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
So we spoke briefly about alcohol earlier, but that's not really considered a drug, is it? Why don't we think of alcohol as one of the drugs?
It's a good question. It's one that we put to David Nutt.
Yeah, alcohol is a fascinating drug. There's no question it's a drug. It's a drug at a pharmacological level. It interacts with many different receptors in the brain. That's actually why it's so appealing, because you can kind of use it to stimulate yourself. You can use it to relax yourself. You can use it to have social activities. You can use it to deaden the pain. Some people use it, don't recommend that, to sleep. So alcohol, it's really the sort of harlequin drug. Why it's not called a drug, that's a really great question. Part of it's historic. Alcohol use, we've now dated back to about 20 to 30,000 BC, where in the early hominids in Africa were brewing mead, taking honey, fermenting honey and using that. Until about the 1850s, most water in Britain was contaminated with other people's feces. And the only safe drink, even for children, was beer. So beer became a drink that could be used safely. So alcohol in the form of beer has been part of, you know, basically our culture for thousands of years. And therefore, it does have a privileged place. The drinks industry has kind of learnt to make sure that people don't understand that alcohol is a drug. And it's been very successful in that sense, a sort of disinformation campaign.
So yeah, it's partly because it's been around for so long and partly because it's beneficial to the huge drinks industry for us not to think of it as a drug.
It's interesting because for most of us, it is just a kind of part of life. It's part of the furniture of life. Mm-hmm. But it's actually one of the most harmful substances on the planet to humans, isn't it? I mean, it really screws a lot of people up.
Yeah.
And yet I just use it, you know, what I think of as in moderation. Mm. And I sort of feel like, yeah, I'm not giving that up.
So quite famously, a while ago, David Nutt produced data that suggested that booze is actually more harmful to society than heroin or crack. And kind of no one really wants to hear it.
Exactly. Thanks, David.
That's the problem. Yeah. People are like, but I do like a drink, so...
Yeah, thanks, David, but it's your round.
Yeah. He co-owns a bar.
He does not.
He co-owns a bar, which is like my favourite detail about him. But he says that if you were just to invent alcohol now and then apply kind of food safety standard criteria to it,
right,
then people would say the safe limit of alcohol is... one glass of wine a year.
What?
Yeah, it's that stark. It's like this would never get through the kind of checks that
that's mental.
People are just like, well, no, this is a poison. this is poisonous. So you shouldn't really have that. But we're kind of willfully ignorant of that.
Yeah. No. And I plan to stay that way.
Yeah. Did you do the quiz?
I did do the quiz. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
How did you get on? So this is a quiz that sort of. You just answer basically how much you drink and how much you know about and how much.
I was a bit outraged by the. I got the suggestion at the end of it that I've got an increasing problem.
Yeah, which I think's, I mean, you, as far as I can tell, you don't drink a great deal. I got told I was borderline. I basically don't drink. I mean, I don't know who's put this.
David Nutt's done this,
yeah,
hasn't he?
Yeah. I was going to, you know, give the listeners the web address to do this quiz, but I think the quiz is nonsense.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because neither
I'm
of
fine.
Us are...
I don't have a problem.
Yeah, and that those are the words of a man who, of course, doesn't have a problem. But I genuinely, I mean... And you'll attest to this. I genuinely don't.
You are an absolute lightweight.
Yeah, right. I'm a total lightweight and I never drink.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm borderline, everyone else has got real problems. Yeah. But that would be my argument. So, yeah, we're all incredibly, certainly in this country, and I think sort of across the world, really, very comfortable with the idea of alcohol as certainly not being a hard drug and essentially not even being a drug at all, even though it very much is. And when we think about hard drugs, we're like, well, they are obviously much more addictive than alcohol.
Yeah, right.
But is that true?
So, because one of the real challenges in understanding drugs and dealing with the problem of or dealing with people who use drugs is that some people become addicted. Now, it's really important to say that not everyone becomes addicted. In fact, when we look at addictiveness of different drugs, the drug that probably is most addictive, strangely, is tobacco. It's estimated that about 40% of all people who smoke tobacco become addicted to nicotine or to cigarettes. Whereas if you look at heroin, it's about 30%. With cocaine, it's about 25%. Alcohol's about 15%. Cannabis is about 10%. The reasons for those differences are twofold, and it's quite complicated, so I'll just take you through it slowly. There are two major factors in propensity to addiction. The first is actually the nature of the drug. The faster the drug gets into the brain, the more likely it is to be addictive. So that's why cocaine, interestingly, it gets in very, very fast. It's more addictive than speed, because amphetamine, which gets in more slowly. Heroin gets in faster than codeine, so it's more addictive than codeine. And tobacco gets in pretty fast, because smoking a cigarette gets your nicotine into the brain about as fast as if you injected nicotine intravenously. So the speed of onset is one factor. And then the second variable, of course, is the person. As I said already, you know, most people, even with tobacco, most people don't become addicted. And that tells us that there's a difference in individuals. And those differences come from either genetic differences, which we know quite a bit about in relation to alcohol, less about in relation to other drugs, or they come about from personal difficulties, like the reason people are using drugs. So we know, for instance, now that the largest group of people in middle age who are dependent on alcohol are using it to deal with stress and depression, which in the short term it helps numb the pain, the psychological pain, but over time they become dependent. So the reason for use is also an important factor in determining whether you're likely to become addicted.
So yeah, surprisingly, tobacco more addictive than heroin.
Yeah, I mean, it's also more available, isn't it? So, you know.
But that's another one. Like David was saying, there's a complex suite of factors.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, that range from obviously the type of drug, access. Access is quite important. Do you have access to this drug? Other environmental factors, like how are you feeling? Are you stressed? And then literally, as you were saying, like who you are. So genetic factors and developmental factors all sort of come into it. But I do think it's really important to emphasise that most people who take drugs, any drug, don't get addicted.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, because you have this idea of something like heroin, you couldn't even have heroin once because you immediately get addicted.
Yeah.
And
actually
60% of people would not.
No. But I mean, so some people have a like what's termed an addictive personality, don't they? Where they sort of they do get those highs and then they crave them again and again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I'm that person at all. But I remember as a kid, you know, like heroin was this. It was like the bogeyman. It was like people said, if you ever try heroin, you know, that's it. Your life is over. You're going to end up in a gutter somewhere with a needle sticking out your arm. And in some ways, you know, that's kind of the PR spin of it. And I don't think enough was ever done about the addictiveness of tobacco.
Well, you say, I mean, that, but actually, when you look at, so smoking in England, for example, has reduced by, like, it's quite good. It's like a billion cigarettes a year, which is about like a quarter. So it's about a quarter less.
Okay.
And smoking prevalence has gone down, I think, by about 15%. So you're smart. You can work out that what that means is that not only are fewer people smoking, but the people who are smoking, smoking less. And so so it's really good. And there's about, I think it's 16% of adults in England now smoke, which is feels low.
I suppose it does. Yeah.
And fewer young people are taking it up. And when you look at it's been a fairly steady decline, but there was a real turning point when at the turn of the century, actually, where there was just a comprehensive tobacco control strategy that the government imposed and successive governments have gone along with and built on. So everything from, you know, mass media campaigns to, you know, heavy taxes on tobacco to making sure that you get free access through the NHS if you want to try and quit smoking. That's for everyone. Advertising bans, obviously, the getting rid of any kind of attractive imagery on packs. And all of that has had an effect. You can see the effect it's had. So you kind of feel like, well, if you wanted to, you could do a similar thing with alcohol.
Yeah.
Because your starting position is quite similar.
Wow, that's a thought, isn't it? Because, I mean, imagine a scenario where that is actually going to happen, can you?
You can't. But I do think it's possible. I think that those public health measures that have been proven to work with something as addictive as tobacco, there's no reason why you couldn't use that playbook on alcohol. And the question is, you know, would you want to? And I think David Nutt would say, well, yeah.
Yeah, because it causes so much harm.
So much harm. Yeah. And it's so widespread and it's so accepted. There's a bit of it's sort of good news and bad news about the people who are addicted to any substance, any drug. So it's mainly, or who do you think it probably is? Like what age group?
It's the affluent sort of middle class sort of midlifers, isn't it?
It's baby boomers. I don't really know about kind of the demographic in terms of sort of affluence and stuff like that. But baby boomers are much more so, and it's increasing for all sorts of reasons. So if you look at people over 55 using drug treatment services for cannabis in the last 15 years, that's gone up 800%.
What?
Yeah, and for over 65, it's gone up 1,000%.
No.
And in that, yeah, so that you kind of go, that is a big problem there. Whereas you look at 18 and 19-year-olds, and it's in the same time period, in 15 years, it's gone down 25%. And it's pretty much the same story for everything else as well. So alcohol, crack, opioids, all of the other drugs, really. People over 55, it's gone up 200% in 15 years. And 18, 19-year-olds... gone down 25%.
So these are people who were basically teenagers through the 1970s, probably before all these public health measures came in.
Exactly.
So all their behaviours and their values were basically set up in their teenage years before they really had access to enough information.
Well, not just access, the information wasn't there.
Yeah,
the information wasn't being given to them.
Yeah.
Whereas young people today just seems it's less of an issue.
Yeah.
I think less people are drinking, less people are getting into problems or seeking help for the problem. I suppose that's the only caveat that you need to make is this, that is a stat about people who are using drug treatment services.
Yeah. But basically, today's teenagers are quite sensible.
And
dull.
Square. Boring. Yeah.
Not legends.
But if you're listening, young people, keep that going. That's a really good thing. I read a really interesting piece by a lady who's now a neuroscientist, but who had a cocaine addiction when she was younger. She's written a book about it. So both her personal experience and then the science. And she wrote this really interesting thing about A process and B process in terms of addiction. It really made sense to me. So she said that the A process is the mind-altering activity. So whether that's the rush of cocaine or the sedation of alcohol, because that's how alcohol works. And that gives you pleasure. And then the B process is what the brain does in response to that, which is it resets. And it's got this furious drive to try and return you back to the baseline.
Okay.
And it's really good at it. And so it rushes you back during the B process. And it's so good that you need more and more of the drug to feel the A process. And then the B process just kicks in almost immediately until you get to a point where you're only really feeling B, which is like the horrible hangover come down.
Yeah, get me out
like
of it.
Like desperately trying to like bring everything back down.
Okay.
And I mean, pretty much everything that you read about the effect of drugs makes you think, no, thanks, actually.
Yeah, it's not fun for long, is it?
No, no. Unless you are, I suppose, if you're one of the many, many people who won't get addicted to drugs. But still, the come down, the hangover, whatever it is horrible. Like and there's not really any way around that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I suppose that people accept it, don't they? The hangover, certainly on alcohol, I always just thought, well, that's part and parcel.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems I've found is the just lack of productivity afterwards. Yeah. It's like, you know, it takes too long for you to sort of start to feel like, okay, I'm just going to get on with my life now. You know, it's like, okay, I've lost a couple of days or, you know, and not through illness as such, just sort of not quite being on
just
it.
Not being on it. Sort of lethargy, kind of dullness in your mind. Are you hungover today, by the way?
No, seem it?
Interesting. So drugs can wreak havoc on your brain, really, and then consequently your body, and then potentially your community, and that is kind of where the war on drugs comes from. But I wanted to ask David what those sort of aggressive laws and measures have meant for people who are trying to study drugs.
The biggest collateral damage from the war on drugs is actually it's a war on research and it's a war on patients. The war on drugs has basically put the drugs we want to research, like psilocybin, like LSD, like magic mushrooms, like MDMA, into what's called Schedule 1 Class A. And that means it's virtually impossible to research them. It takes you about a year to get a license. And then the burden of bureaucracy in order to work with them adds vast amounts. It probably increases the cost of research tenfold. And this is completely ridiculous. It's all bureaucratic. It's all based on a false lie, which is that these drugs are very dangerous. So, for instance, when I want to work on magic mushrooms, I have to have a special safe put in to my laboratory to store the magic mushrooms or the psilocybin. And I say, why can't I store it alongside the heroin that I use for my other research? And they say, no, you can't do that because it's a Schedule 1 drug and heroin's a Schedule 2 drug. It's a medicine. And I say, yeah, but if anyone breaks in, they're not going to take the mushrooms. They're going to take the heroin, aren't they? And they say, no, the law tells us you've got to. And this is the stupidity, the bureaucracy that has been generated around the scheduling of drugs. It's been so destructive to research. I think the bureaucracy around drug control is the worst censorship of research in the history of the world. I can't think of any example where research has been so severely damaged by regulatory controls. For 50 years, no one has been able to research drugs like LSD or psilocybin or MDMA. And our group have really broken the barrier there, but it's been an enormous cost. And it's also wasted. It takes several years to study each drug because of the bureaucracy. And all the time, patients who could be benefiting are being denied access.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that I'd never really considered. But obviously, it's a real ball ache trying to study any of these drugs, even when you think that they might have potential benefits.
It seems to me like it's a ball ache to study the drugs that the politicians don't know or haven't used in the past. So, you know, I can imagine that they're like heroin. Well, you know, we kind of know where we are with heroin. Mushrooms, it's like, well, I've never done mushrooms, so it must be really bad. Or, you know, just MDMA, you know, maybe they're sort of saying that has to be locked away because it's a dangerous thing that young people use. I mean, you know, a few young people have died using it, therefore it's probably politically, like, you know, just expedient to say that has to, you know, that's Schedule 1, that has to be locked away, you know. And so these become ridiculous political decisions. Whereas like MDMA, I know you can use or is being used in helping people overcome trauma and things like that.
So yeah. I mean, there's
medical
loads of
applications. It's positive.
Exciting medical research is being done, like obviously having to jump through a lot of hoops. But you're right to say, I think that actually I'd need to check up on this, but I'm sure that David Nutt ended up leaving his post essentially because he got with the government because he got fed up about their kind of policy-based evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Policy, like he just like they knew what they wanted him to find, and when he wasn't finding it, they were just sort of ignoring it. They have a, because it is like it feels like it's a moral question, and you understand how that can happen, but it is also counter to what the science is telling you. So it's sort of a bit.
It's sort of driven by an ideology which says, you know, this has caused headlines in the past, therefore, you know, actually you don't get that many headlines about heroin use or whatever, because it's just sort of there in the background of our lives. But when a teenager dies when they've taken, you know, bad ecstasy or something like that, you know, that's all over the front pages of the tabloids as, you know, this massive story. So it seems to me like, you know, that those drugs are considered so much worse than anything else.
Yeah.
And mushrooms is like the safest thing you can take, pretty much.
And also looks like it could be really good for treating depression.
Yeah.
So psilocybin, which is the active ingredient of magic mushrooms, this has been investigated by a guy, Imperial, who's the head of, and this is a good department to be head of, Center for Psychedelic Research. Fantastic. And he's very hopeful that not only might it work for depression, but also for anxiety, potentially even eating disorders. And it's not entirely clear how it's working, but it seems to reduce blood flow to certain areas in the amygdala and resting activity, and that is an area that is overactive in depression and anxiety. So it might be to do with that. But also, the way that it's working, seemingly, in contrast to other antidepressants, which tend to dull emotions, they just sort of make everything kind of drag everything down, if you like, which is better than being depressed, but also a sort of suboptimal, you'd say. And what this seems to do is it kind of heightens emotional responses and almost encourages sort of active confrontation of your depression and your issues. And that seemingly maybe leads to more enduring shifts in mindset.
Okay.
It obviously needs more testing and larger, you know, groups and controls and things like that. But it's not just psilocybin. LSD looks like it might be good for alcoholism. Ketamine looks like it might be good for depression. Now, you'll be able to figure this out, I think. What is one of the big problems with running these experiments? Let's assume that you can get hold of the stuff. What's a big problem? Just in terms of the way that you would normally run experiments like this.
Well, getting the volunteers for a start. You have to have the right kind of people.
Yeah.
But you know whether you're in the placebo arm or not, don't you?
Exactly that. Exactly that. So you want a control group. You really want to do it kind of double blind. And you just can't.
Yeah.
Because if you haven't been given LSD, or you haven't been given ketamine, or you haven't been given magic mushrooms, you know.
I know.
You're just like, oh.
It's really tricky. A friend of mine took part in the channel, this was years and years ago, Channel 4 did like a drugs live thing where you took MDMA on the program and you went into an fMRI scanner and they scanned you while you were there. And he said, 1 week they were in the placebo arm of the trial, and the next week they were in the other arm, you know, or the other way around. They didn't know where they were going to be. And he said it was just so obvious that he was now going to have to spend 4 hours in an fMRI machine, totally sober.
Yeah.
And he said it was the most boring time. But he said, you know, he said that home office grade MDMA that David Nutt and he said it's good stuff.
It's good stuff, was it? Yeah. But that is an issue. So they think that they might, one thing they're looking at is using sort of what they call an active placebo. So like, for example, a very, very low dose of LSD. So you do.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So that might do it. It's quite interesting. I'd never heard the idea of an active placebo. But what ketamine seems to do with depression is you have these, we were talking about them earlier, with your neurons, they have these spines that are kind of like little outgrowths that receive signals from neighbouring neurons. And when people are stressed, you seem to lose some of these spines in the prefrontal cortex.
Okay.
And ketamine, and this has just been studied in mice, always the massive. By the way, just in mice.
Yeah.
When you really stress out some mice, poor old mice, that you see them lose these spines in the prefrontal cortex. And then you give them ketamine, and it seems to promote the formation of new functional spines, so improve your sort of synaptic function. But it also, ketamine happens, it affects depression really quickly. So before even
that sort of physical change is taking place, it seems to improve it. So ketamine looks really encouraging in terms of tackling depression. But all of these things, as David Nutt was saying, are quite hard to research.
Right. But he is at least starting to get somewhere with this. He and others.
Yeah, him and others, yeah.
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 Okay.
So our big question off the back of all of this is, will we ever have safe, legal and ethical recreational drugs? And David has quite an interesting perspective on this, because that is one of the things that he himself is looking into.
Well, I think we can certainly have safe and we can certainly have legal. And I think actually to do that is ethically necessary. I think there's a moral imperative, and that is why I have been pushing for so long, 15 years now, to make an alternative to alcohol. I think there's a moral imperative to give people what they want from alcohol in a drug which is less harmful than alcohol. But that's what I want, and that's what I want for my kids and my grandkids. And to my mind, that is totally an ethical, rational approach. Government should be investing in this. They shouldn't be putting barriers in our way.
So what he's doing is he's trying to develop a kind of an alco synth.
Right,
And it's called Alcarel. So it's a sort of safe, synthetic alcohol substitute. And so what he's trying to do is create something that gives you the kind of the relaxation, the kind of the social lubrication, but without giving you the hangover, the option of getting absolutely paralytic, and crucially, all of the health issues. So, you know, strokes and
liver damage, blah, blah,
liver damage, heart, all of the stuff that alcohol does.
Nice.
And so what he's looked at, and this is very clever, and he says that this is the easy part. I don't think this was the easy part. But what alcohol does is it stimulates GABA receptors, they're called, and it kind of stops neurons from firing so much, and that basically has a calming effect. And there are 15 different types of GABA receptor, and alcohol will bond to all of them. And so what he's thought is, can you stimulate those GABA receptors without alcohol? So just produce the kind of the tipsy bliss.
Yeah.
And he's worked out that you don't need to stimulate all 15. There's just there's a certain number that you need to stimulate. I don't think he'll say which ones they are, because I guess that's
proprietary information,
which is fair enough. And then once you've kind of decided that will be the thing that you need, then you've just got to try and create the right molecule, which is hard but doable, and it's synthetic, although him and his business partner are looking to see if that does exist anywhere out in nature, because that would be preferable, not particularly in terms of effect, but just in terms of marketing. I think he's probably right. I think if you say to people, and this is naturally
occurring,
it gives you, then people are much more. So it's why cannabis, for example, these days is.
And then you can call it plant-based.
Yeah, exactly.
It's absolute golden.
So vogue. But the really hard thing is actually bringing it to market, because you have to jump through all sorts of safety hoops, as you would hope. You have to demonstrate it definitely doesn't produce the kind of toxicity that alcohol does. But he thinks, you know, I think he's quite confident that it will happen. He says, I think it tastes rank on its own. But then I'd sort of argue that alcohol tastes rank on its own. So I don't think that's an issue.
Yeah, nobody's drinking alcohol. Pure.
It won't give you a hangover.
Nice.
And you sort of think, so will the alcohol industry, how will they react to that? And his thing is,
they're not going to like that.
Well, his thing is, it might end up being like Coca-Cola's relationship with stevia. So stevia is the sweetener, no calorie sweetener, and Coca-Cola just have sort of embraced that. And in the same way that tobacco companies have gone vaping, he thinks that you know, the alcohol industry are aware that people are starting to, some groups anyway, drink less, be more interested in non-alcoholic drinks, and so he thinks that they might well embrace it and just go, fine, we'll offer both. If you want
real
alcohol, great, we've got that for you. If you want sort of no alcohol stuff that tastes the same, we've got that for you. If you want this weird new alco synth stuff that doesn't give you a hangover but gives you some of the, you know, the sort of tipsy effects, we can do that.
Yeah.
So it's quite exciting.
Yeah, no, I like that.
I'd be bang up for that.
I'd definitely volunteer for the trial.
Yeah.
I'm in, David.
I suppose when it comes to sort of the equivalent of with other drugs, I don't think I can see that because I don't know how you avoid all of the
I don't need
effects.
All that though. I still need a bit of an alcohol kind of hit. I don't need the other stuff anymore. I really
but,
don't.
But if, and I have no idea what the workaround is or if this is even vaguely possible, but if there were sort of mind-bending, mind-altering drugs, which is all drugs, and they were 100% non-addictive, you could guarantee that they were non-addictive, would you try them? And I'm like, Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, you can go to work the next day and it's all fine and, you know, get on with stuff. I love it.
I think because of the way that the other drugs work, I don't think that's going to be possible, personally. And I think there's a reason that David Nutt is trying to develop sort of safe alcohol and not safe anything else.
Yeah.
Also, it's a harder sell, isn't it? Say safe heroin. And honestly, this heroin will give you no problems.
Just imagine David just like failing to get any licensing and just meeting around the back by the bins.
And is this pure fake safe heroin, David? Or have you cut that with washing powder?
Oh, dear. Well, I mean, what a strange world, isn't it? Where you think, actually, it's such a fundamental human thing, as he says. You know, always done it, always will do it. We should try and make it as safe as possible. You know, it should be, you know, those hurdles just shouldn't be there.
Because I don't think you would be able to find a drug addict who would say to you, oh, no, I want the real thing. Like, if I said, look, I can give you the high that you're craving, you won't get addicted, you won't have the horrible low.
Yeah.
Of course they'll take that.
Yeah, of course they will. Maybe not Bez.
No, Bez would want the good stuff. Eureka is a Stack production presented by me, Rick Edwards, and Dr. Michael Brooks. The production team is Andrea Lucia Peters, Luke Moore, and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, David Nutt. If you like the show, please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a big difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.